A couple of weeks ago, Alan and Sheila and Val and I went to Chartwell in Kent, Winston Churchill's home. It's a fascinating place. If you've never been there, do go. It's very interesting. And apparently, I learned that day that one of those regular visitors after the war was Field Marshal Montgomery, or Monty, as he was affectionately known. That reminded me of a story I heard recently, that Monty was asked to read the lesson in church from the Sermon on the Mount, and he concluded the reading by saying, "These were Jesus' words, and I happen to agree with him." Well, with respect to Monty, the fact that he agrees doesn't matter a fig. What's more, he may have been a good military leader, and the name of Monty may be remembered for a couple of generations, but I'm absolutely certain that in 2,000 years' time, hundreds of millions of people throughout the world will not be gathering each week to sing their praises to Monty and express their allegiance to him. But they will be gathering today, praise Jesus and worship Jesus. And we're here this morning to listen and learn from the words of Jesus, God in human form. And we need to take very seriously what he has to say. Earlier this year, Val and I went to Epsom Playhouse to a concert by Simon and Garfunkel tribute band. And as they sang their classic songs, as they were singing, projected on the screen behind them were scenes from the newsreels and popular culture of the time, from the time when they were writing their songs. So there were scenes from the Vietnam War and the Cold War, the race riots in America, those sorts of things were projected on the screen behind them, which helped to put their songs into context. And it reminded me of how one theologian described Luke's gospel. This is Richard Hayes, whose book, you might remember, we used a couple of years ago when we preached an overview of the four gospels. But he says this: Luke's gospel is played out on center stage in front of the footlights, while a screen at the back of the stage displays a kaleidoscopic series of flickering sepia-toned images from Israel's scripture. That's what we call the Old Testament. The images can flash by almost unnoticed. However, if the viewer pays careful attention, there are many moments in which the words or gestures of the players on stage mirror something in the shifting background. I think that's a good description. So as we continue our quest for this year of working our way through Luke's gospel, let's bear that in mind, because we're going to look at three incidents where the Old Testament background will help us to understand the meaning of what's going on in the foreground as Luke describes these encounters with Jesus, the encounters he had in the last days of his earthly life. We're going to look at three. Two were read to us, and plus one other. And these three incidents all took place in the temple in Jerusalem, the center, really, of the nation of Israel. Luke has described Jesus' journey towards Jerusalem, and he's described how Jesus stays his entry into the city on what we call Palm Sunday by riding on a donkey. He was deliberately enacting the prophecy of one of the Old Testament prophets who had written that Israel's king would come riding on a donkey. And he then weeps over the city, prophesies its destruction, and then he enters the temple, which dominated the city, and was one of the wonders of the ancient world. Under King Herod, the temple had been rebuilt over a period of about 50 years with a magnificent stone-built structure. This is a model of it. If you go to Jerusalem today, you can see this model of the temple, with the Holy of Holies in the middle as the centerpiece, surrounded by concentric courts, where somewhere only the priests were allowed, by a series of courts to the largest area, the court of the Gentiles, where people from any background were allowed to talk and pray. And that is where Jesus went to teach in the days leading up to Good Friday. And that's where Jesus' disciples continued to gather and speak about Jesus after his resurrection. But it appears that what had been intended as a place where all could gather and to think and talk and pray to God had become a center of commerce. It had become a busy marketplace. So we read in Luke's account, when Jesus entered the temple courts, he began to drive out those who were selling. "It is written," he said to them, "my house will be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers." Now we only get these two verses in Luke's account, a little more in Mark and Matthew. So it's difficult to understand what's really going on. And if you're like me, we're left with some questions, all sorts of questions. Why did Jesus do this? Did he clear them all out? Or was this just a token gesture? Was it just a few? Surely they were providing an important service. They were providing the sacrifices that the Jews needed, changing money to buy the sacrifices. What was the problem? And did it have any lasting effect? If we'd have gone back a few days later, would we have noticed any different? Well, I believe that the clue to answering those questions questions is in the words that Jesus said, which are quotes from two of the Old Testament prophets, from Isaiah and Jeremiah. And when the New Testament writers quote from the Old Testament, they tend just to pick out a few words, but the intention is that that's a sort of shorthand for the full passage that they're quoting from. And if we're going to understand, we need to look at the full passage. So first of all, my house will be a house of prayer. It's a quote from Isaiah 56, and I've shortened this slightly, but this is what Isaiah writes. This is what the Lord says. Let no foreigner who is bound to the Lord say, the Lord will surely exclude me from his people. Foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath without desecrating it and who hold fast to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. From the beginning of the nation of Israel, when God first called Abraham, God made it clear that he was providing for them and blessing them, not so that they could be a sort of holy hovel, so they could enjoy God's blessings for themselves, but so that other nations will be blessed through them. And what have they done? The area of the temple that was meant to be accessible to foreigners, to non-Jews, the area that was supposed to encourage them to pray to God, have been turned into a busy marketplace. And surely that's a warning to us, isn't it? Us Christians today, God has not blessed us so that we could keep his blessing to ourselves, so that we could just enjoy his blessing. He has blessed us so that we can be a blessing to others. We're to share the good news that we have received and come to believe in. We are to make our buildings and our meetings and our language accessible to all. That was God's intention for blessing us. So that's one quote, but he goes on to quote from Jeremiah, because he says, you have made God's temple a den of robbers. That's a sort of safe haven for robbers. And at first sight, we could think that what made Jesus angry was a sort of financial exploitation of the sellers and money changers. Perhaps they were making excessive profits. But the word used for robbers in the Greek is rebels rather than thieves. And I think when we look at the passage from Jeremiah that Jesus quotes from, it's quite clear that the issue is much more serious. So this is what Jeremiah says. Hear the word of the Lord, all you people of Judah who come through these gates to worship the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your ancestors forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal, and follow other gods you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which bears my name, and say, we are safe to do all these detestable things? Has this house which bears my name become a den of robbers to you that I have been watching, declares the Lord? They're harsh words, aren't they? Harsh words from God to his people, accusing them of a whole range of things, including idolatry and insincerity and hypocrisy. They were happy to turn up on a Sunday morning or the equivalent, sing a few repetitive choruses about the temple, and then go on with their lives for the rest of the week. Without a thought about God and his commands for how they should live, their religion, if you like, was an insurance policy. We're safe, they said, provided we do our religious duty. Then God will be happy, and we can live as we please for the rest of the time. And it's not too difficult, is it, to draw a lesson for us today from that? Because we can so easily fall into the same way of thinking. We can turn up on a Sunday morning, recite the equivalent of, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, and carry on living as though God wasn't bothered about how we use our time and our money or how we treat other people. We forget that God is watching. But at the end of this passage, the Lord through Jeremiah says, but I have been watching, declares the Lord. Well, there's considerable debate amongst scholars about the questions I asked a few moments ago. Why did Jesus do it? What did it achieve? Was he expecting any sort of permanent change or reform in the temple? But most see what Jesus did in the temple as a symbolic action, a foretaste of what was to happen to this magnificent temple. Because 40 years later, when the Jewish people provoked the Romans exacted a terrible price. The entire temple was destroyed. And if you go there today, there are just a few foundation stones left, what Jewish believers call the Wailing Wall. And it's a warning, I think, that God will not remain patient with his disobedient people forever. Yes, he is a God of love, but he's also a God of judgment. Because Jeremiah's prophecy continued, "Go now to the place of Shiloh, where I first made a dwelling for my name, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. While you were doing all these things, declares the Lord, I spoke to you again and again, but you did not listen. I called you, but you did not answer. Therefore, what I did to Shiloh, I will now do to the house that bears my name, the temple you trust in, the place I gave to you and your ancestors. I will thrust you from my presence, just as I did all your fellow Israelites, the people of Ephraim." I think the destruction of the Jerusalem temple is a sort of object lesson for the judgment and destruction that features in the examples of Jesus' teaching that Luke records for us in the following verses in the next chapter. Now, there's been increasing conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders, which Luke has recorded for us, which we may have noticed as we work through Luke's gospel. In chapter 5, we read they complained about him. In chapter 6, they are furious and begin to plot against him. In chapter 11, they opposed him and asked hostile questions. In chapter 15, they criticized him. In chapter 16, they sneered at Jesus. And in chapter 19, a sort of escalation, if you like, in chapter 19, we read, every day he was teaching at the temple, but the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him. Yet they could not find any way to do it because all the people hung on his words. So that's the context of the parable that was read to us, the parable that, which we call the tenants in the vineyard. The religious leaders of the time were incensed at Jesus. His teaching was undermining their authority. It was diminishing their power. And they were determined to get rid of him, but they didn't know how to do it because there were many who were impressed by him. There were some who had put their trust in him and become his disciples. So that's the context. And Jesus tells this story about the tenants and the vineyard. I won't repeat it. I'm not going to read it again. It's a thinly disguised parable about the very religious leaders who are questioning him. And again, it's helpful to see the Old Testament backdrop. In the Old Testament, the people of Israel, the people of God, are sometimes referred to as a vine who God has planted in a vineyard. You can find examples of that. The main examples in Isaiah 5. And Psalm 80, they're the clearest examples of this metaphor. And it's Isaiah chapter 5, Isaiah writes, oh, there's a vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones, planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but sought bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. So the listeners in the temple that day would have clearly understood that background as they heard Jesus' story. Indeed, we read it after the story that the leaders were incensed because they realized that Jesus was talking about them. And so the story is of people who worked in the vineyard, and they were tenants. They didn't own it. God had provided it, and they paid rent to the owner. And that was the story of Israel. And if we read the Old Testament, we read about a succession of prophets, people who spoke God's word to the people when they got things wrong, to remind people of what they owed to God. people, if you like, in the context of this story, people to collect the rent. And if we read the Old Testament, or if we read the little summary we get in the book of Hebrews, we see that these prophets were invariably mistreated, rejected, and sometimes killed. You would not have got life insurance if your job being a prophet in Old Testament times. And then as the story reaches its climax, Jesus speaks these words. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. "This is the heir," they said. "Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What poignant words those are, spoken prophetically just a few days before Jesus himself, the beloved Son of God, would be arrested and falsely accused, tried, and nailed to a cross to die in agony. And why? What motivated the people who worked the vineyard to do this awful deed? "This is the heir," they said. "Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." They were not content to be tenants. They wanted the inheritance. They wanted to be owners, and they would do whatever it took, including murder, to become the owners of the vineyard. And there's still some who think that way. The land belongs to the nation of Israel. It's ours, they say, and they will do whatever it takes to become the owners. But they're not the owners, and they never were. God is the owner of the land. Through the law of Moses, God speaks these words from Leviticus. "The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine, and you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers." That's from the NIV. Other translations use the word tenants. The people were allowed the land as their possession, but the ownership was always with God. And I believe that this story is a warning to us. Which group of people would you say bear the closest resemblance to the Pharisees in Jesus' day? Surely it's evangelical Christians, and especially their leaders. And if we're not careful, I think we fall into the same mindset. We're not content to be tenants. We want to be the owners of their church. So we start thinking of it as our church. We set the rules. We decide who's welcome and who isn't. We decide on the programs and priorities. We want to be the owner rather than seek the will of the one who is the rightful owner. So this parable, I think, is for us as well. And that's the parable, and it certainly caused a stir. Jesus ends the story with these words. "What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others." When the people heard this, they said, "God forbid." And isn't that exactly the same reaction that people would say today when the idea is raised of judgment with God as their judge? "God forbid. Surely not. God is all about love, isn't he? It's his job to forgive. Surely he won't judge us just for doing what most other people do." I think that view is rather like us creating God in our image, hypothesizing about what we prefer God to be like rather than what he's revealed to us through the words of Jesus. And the God who Jesus reveals is a God of love and a God of judgment. And deep down, we know that this is justice. Supposing for a moment that you were well off and you owned a nice big house in Wimbledon. And when the Wimbledon tennis tournament was on, you had the opportunity to rent out your house for a month and go and have a holiday in Greece and still end up with a decent profit. And supposing you came back from your holiday in Greece and found that the people you'd let the house to had moved the whole family in, they'd trashed the furniture, they'd thrown out all your precious possessions, they'd shredded the title deeds, and they changed all the locks. They decided they weren't content to be tenants. They wanted to be owners. What would you do? Would you sit back and say, "Well, that doesn't really matter"? Of course you wouldn't. You'd do whatever it takes to get justice, to restore the house to its rightful owner. And surely it's not surprising that God will do the same. Well, Jesus goes on to emphasize this theme of judgment in the next few verses. And this time he echoes three other passages from the Old Testament, and we're not going to have time to study these. this morning, but I do want to take a few minutes to look at the following confrontation in the temple. So it comes later in Luke chapter 20, because I think Luke has deliberately included this to make the point more personal. So we read in verse 20 of chapter 20, keeping a close watch on him, they, that's the religious leaders, sent spies who pretended to be sincere. They hoped to catch Jesus in something he said so that they might hand him over to the power and authority of the governor. They asked him questions, but they weren't interested in the answer. They just wanted to catch him out. So the spies questioned him, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach what is right, and that you do not show partiality, but teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Our flattery has always been a very powerful weapon, hasn't it?" And then they pose a very clever question. Is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now that is clever, because if Jesus says no, then they would immediately report him to the Roman authorities, get him tried for insurrection. You can imagine they go along and say, "Look, this strange fellow from Galilee is inciting all the people to stop paying their taxes." We can imagine what would have happened. But on the other hand, if he says yes, then the leaders would immediately turn to the crowds following Jesus and say, "Look, this person you've been listening to, this person who calls himself a prophet sent from God, he can't even do a little thing to stand up to the Romans. What a wimp. He's just a collaborator with the Roman authorities. Surely you don't want to listen to him." So it was a clever question. But I think the answer was 10 times cleverer. It's brilliant, because in just a few words, Jesus lays down the principle which has governed correct relationship between church and state from that time since. The common coinage of the day was Roman coinage, which bore the likeness and inscription of the Roman emperor, Caesar. But in addition to the taxes that the Jewish people had to pay to Rome, they also paid a temple tax towards the running of the temple for all the priests and the sacrifices. And they considered that paying this tax in the normal coins, bringing money into the temple which bore the image of Caesar, would be blasphemous. It would break the second commandment. And therefore they had a different set of coins without any image which they used in the temple. Hence the money changers. So that's the background. We read on. Jesus saw through their duplicity and said to them, "Show me a denarius," that's the coin, "whose image and inscription are on it?" "Caesar's," they replied. So it happened that the coin they produced was the normal secular coin rather than the temple coin. And he said to them, "Then give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's." So he's saying, look, it bears Caesar's image, therefore give it back to Caesar. The Romans have provided roads and water supply and public services and security. It would be quite wrong to withhold the tax they collect to cover the cost. So that's one part of his answer. And I think the apostles picked up this in their teaching in the New Testament. We're told, aren't we, in the letters that Paul writes and Peter writes, that we're to be subject to the ruling authority. We can protest peacefully, we can argue, we can generate petitions, but when it comes to vandalizing UNES cameras or gluing ourselves to the M25, then surely that's not giving to Caesar what is Caesar's. Now it would be interesting to have a discussion about where we draw the line, but Jesus doesn't stop there. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, what bears Caesar's image, and, he says, give to God what is God's. And what is God's? What or who bears God's image? Well, we can miss the point because we're not very familiar with our Old Testament. But every one of his listeners would have known the answer to that question. Who bears God's image? We do, don't we? On the first page of our Bible, we read, "And God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness. So God created mankind in his own image, in the image of God he created them. Male and female he created them." It's said 3 times, isn't it, for emphasis. We bear God's image. And Jesus says we are to give to God what is God's. A coin bears the image of Caesar. Give it to Caesar. But we bear the image of God. He's our rightful owner. Give it to God. So we're to give to God what belongs to him. And that's us. That's you and me. That's ourselves. He is the owner. We are the tenants in his vineyard. And as his tenants, he gives us his creation to look after and care for. And as his tenants, he gives us money to use wisely and selflessly. And as his tenants, he gives us time to use fruitfully. And as his tenants, he gives us various gifts and abilities that we were thinking about in the at the beginning of the year and are portrayed on that notice board to use in the service of others. But we're not the owners of these things. We're the tenants. Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, "You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies, i.e. honor God in the way that you live." So God has made us, we bear his image, and we are to give ourselves to him. And what's more, just a few days later, after these stories, Jesus hung on a cross for us to redeem us. He paid a huge price for us, the price of his death, so that we too can live as friends of God, as we were designed to be, as tenants in his vineyard.